I want you to, for a minute, I'm going to ask you to just sort of, if you want to, you can close your eyes and just listen to what I'm saying and think about this. I'm going to talk about a couple of different events. Some of them you're familiar with and some of them you're not. I want you to imagine for just a minute that you're in the Garden of Eden. And Adam and Eve have just eaten from the tree that they weren't supposed to eat from. And immediately after they did that, they discovered that they were naked. So they decided they needed to clothe themselves in some form or fashion. And right after that happened, God was moving through the garden and he was looking for them, saying, "Where are you?" And when in Genesis 3, when he finds where they are, Adam's explanation is, "We were naked and we were hiding from you because we were afraid." Okay, now let's move a little bit forward in time. We're now at a camp scene, and Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau, and he had just given the birthright that was supposed to go to Esau to his son Jacob, because Jacob's mother favored him, and the two of them, I don't want to use the word conspired, but they got together and his mother wanted the birthright to go to Jacob. And they fooled Isaac because he didn't have good eyesight and he was very old into believing that he was passing on the birthright to Esau when in fact he was passing it on to Jacob. When Esau came back from hunting, he found out that this blessing had been given to his brother. The blessing that he was supposed to get was given to his brother, and that he wasn't gonna be getting it. His reaction to that was what? He was very angry. He decided that the best policy would probably be to kill his brother. And Jacob's mother overheard this and went to Jacob and said, "Your brother's very angry, and the best policy here, I think, is you're gonna need to get out of town. You can go live with my brother so that your brother doesn't have the opportunity to kill you." So he fled. Now I'll move a little further in time from that. The Israelites are outside the promised land, and they decide it's a good idea to send 12 individuals into the promised land to investigate it. I believe the term we use in the Bible is they're referred to as spies, that go into the countryside and check out what things are like. And when they come back to report, two of them give a positive report saying it's a land, it's beautiful, it flows with milk and honey, and it's a wonderful place. And we need to go in there and conquer it. We can do that. 10 of them come back with a negative report and say, "Wow, we can't go in there. Their cities are fortified. The people that live there are giants. We can't go in there. We have absolutely no choice or opportunity to prevail." So what did they do? They didn't go in. And for the next 40 years, they got to wander in the wilderness. I want to move you a little further in time still. Jesus has just been arrested. He's been taken by the military people that represent the Jewish council, and he's taken before the Jewish council. And Peter and one of the other apostles goes with him, not necessarily walking with him, but kind of trailing behind. And when they get to the place where they're going to begin to review Jesus and investigate what all these things that he supposedly did, people that are standing around see Peter standing there and they go, "Aren't you one of those people that was with him? And what did he do?" He denied him not once, not twice, but three times. Okay, now, I want to move you away from that time frame, more into the time frame that we live in. I want you to imagine for a minute, there's a young boy and his father. and they decide they're going to go fishing. So they get in a 14, 15-foot boat. And it's nothing fancy. It's just an open boat, a little nicer than a John boat, but no top on it. But it's a nice enough boat, and they go out fishing. They go out in the lake, and they're catching all kinds of fish, and they're having a really good time, but they're not really paying attention to what's going on behind them. And about the time they're catching these fish and they're putting them in the boat, and they turn around, and there's all of a sudden they hear boom and a bang, and they turn around, and there's this huge storm that's developed behind them, and there's no place for them to go. In order to go back home, they have to go through the storm. They're too close to shore, they can't get off the boat, so they have to stay in the boat, and the storm comes, and it rains so hard that the only thing to do is to lay down in the boat. There's lightning, thunder, crashing, and the boat starts to fill up with water. It's raining so hard, and the rain's hitting them, and it really stings. Now I want to take you to another time. This is the last one. A man and his wife make a short trip. The man has to have some special kind of surgery done. So they go to a special hospital, to a doctor who is skilled and considered to be very good at doing what he does. This hospital is a teaching hospital. And when they go in, the surgeon comes in and starts talking to the man and to the woman, and starts to explain the procedure that they're going to do. And as they always do, they go through the risk factors. These are the things that could potentially go wrong. And they all sound reasonable, and the doctor leaves. But because it's a teaching hospital, over the course of the next 2 hours, seven more doctors, all who are learning how to be doctors, come in, and they go back through all the same information over and over and over again. And this man keeps hearing about, well, this is a good operation, but you know, if we make a mistake, you could be paralyzed. So you hear that 8 times in a 2 hour time frame, and then you get to sleep through the night and wait for the surgery in the next morning. So the question I have for you is, if you take all 6 of those stories, what's the one theme? What's the one thread that's similar in all those stories?
Fear.
When you think about Adam and Eve, they're hiding from God because they were afraid. Why did Jacob leave town?
He was afraid.
His brother was going to kill him. So he left town because he was afraid. When you look at the spies that went into the promised land to check it out, they decided they couldn't do it because they were afraid. There's giants there. There's these cities. We can't conquer this area. Peter. Why in the world would Peter, who walked around with Jesus for 3 years and saw all the things that he did, why would he deny him 3 times?
Fear for his life.
He was afraid. He was afraid the same thing that was happening to Jesus was going to happen to him. What about that little boy and his dad in the boat? What do you think they were going through, laying in the bottom of that boat in the middle of a violent storm with no place to go? Concern, fear. Are we going to make it through this? And I don't know if you've ever been out in a boat before, out in the middle of nowhere, and you're the only thing in the water, and the storm goes through, but it's pretty exciting. Surgery. What do you think that person that was going through that was feeling? I was there for a good reason, but he was probably pretty concerned about it after you hear 8 times that, oh, by the way, you know, you might get paralyzed if we do this. When we think about these things, and that thread, that theme of fear goes through all those sorts of things, and that's why we're going to try and talk a little bit about this series is faith that overcomes blank. And each week it's something different. Well, today we're going to talk a little bit about fear. So can somebody give me a nice, concise definition of what fear is? Somebody want to take a shot at it? There's no right, I mean, emotion? Okay? Say that again.
Being afraid,
okay. Fear of the unknown. Okay, let me run through the, I have here the Webster's Dictionary definition, which obviously means this is what the word actually means. It has several different definitions. The first one is an unpleasant, often strong emotion causing anticipation or awareness of danger. Anxious concern, reason for alarm due to danger. And then there's this other one. This kind of a curious one because it's just a little bit different. It's profound reverence and awe, especially towards God. It's kind of interesting when you think about the definition here. It kind of points in one direction, but it also points in a different direction. And the purpose of this lesson really isn't to dwell on the awe definition of fear, but we can touch on a few points of it because I think they're worthwhile. First of all, when you look through the Bible, I did a word search on my computer. On my Bible, on my computer, and when we think about fear, if you take the term fear of the Lord, and you look that up as a unit, that particular passage of words appears 27 times in the Bible. Almost all of them are in the Old Testament. If you take the words fear God, that's in there another 17 times. And we don't have enough time to go through all those various scriptures, but I think it would be helpful to just look at a few of them. And I think the easiest way to do this is to have you turn to just one book in the Old Testament. Everybody turn over to Proverbs for just a second. Because out of those 27 times that the word fear of the Lord appears in the Bible, 13 of them are in the book of Proverbs. And we're not going to cover all 13 of them, but I do want to go through a few of them. When you think about the book of Proverbs, I think it's actually a really interesting book. It was written by Solomon. And what was Solomon known for? I mean, what was he?
Wisdom.
The theme, if you've read Proverbs very much, you know that the theme of that book revolves around the idea of wisdom. And when you read through this, you see it jump out at you over and over and over again. But let's take a look at a couple of them. Proverbs 1, verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. There's that word wisdom again. Proverbs 8, 13. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogance in an evil way. Proverbs 10, 27. The fear of the Lord prolongs days, but the years of the wicked will be shortened. Proverbs 14, 26 and 27. In the fear of the Lord there is strong confidence, and his child will have a place of refuge. The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life to turn away from the snares of death. Proverbs 16 and 6. In mercy and truth, atonement is provided for iniquity, and by the fear of the Lord, one departs from evil. When a man's ways please the Lord. Proverbs 19, 23. The fear of the Lord leads to life, and he who has it will abide in satisfaction. He will not be visited with evil. And then the last one, Proverbs 22, verse 4. By humility and fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life. So when you go through this, you start seeing these themes. When you fear the Lord, It's the beginning of knowledge. It takes you away, or it leads you away from hate and evil. It prolongs your days. It provides you with confidence. It provides you with a fountain of life. It helps you to better manage your riches and honors and your life. We could go through this. I mean, we could just use this as a study. And David wanted to make sure that we just touched on that briefly. But that's not really the focus of the study for tonight. We want to use the other definition that we're talking about as it relates to fear. So if we look at that for just a second, I'm going to ask this question, and there's no right answer to it. It kind of depends on how you view things. Is fear just a negative emotion?
No.
So is there a positive side to fear? You got an example of a positive side to fear? Okay, so that's the whole of man. Okay. 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 If you think about it for just a minute, who designed human beings?
God
did. He programmed us in certain ways. And I want to give you a little visual picture again. You're walking down in the wilderness, and you're walking down a nice path, and as you walk down the path, about 20 yards in front of you, out pops a grizzly bear. He's huge. I mean, he's a 800, 900 pound bear, and he stands up on his hind legs. What goes through your mind?
Get out of there.
Fear.
Well, fear and get out of there. But it's interesting how God designed us, how he designed our bodies. What if you had to sit there and go, you know, that's a grizzly bear. That's a problem. I think I need to run away. So before I do that, I got to make sure I'm ready to go. Let's see, I got to get my adrenaline up. I get my heart rate up a little bit. Got to get my respiration up a little bit. And by the time you thought through that whole process, the bear would have eaten you. And it doesn't work that way, because God made us differently than that. We have an autonomic system in our body that automatically, you don't even have to think about it. When something like that happens, the grizzly bear pops up, all of a sudden the little adrenal glands on top of your kidneys are starting to shoot out adrenaline, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, your respiration goes up, and you don't even have to think about it. And it's a reaction to what you're seeing happen. So in some cases, things like that, we've been programmed, and it's a positive thing, it helps us. The term that a lot of times they use is a fight or flight reaction when you see things that are dangerous. And you can make decisions much more quickly, because you don't have to think of all the steps you have to do to save yourself. So there is a positive side to some of the fears that we face. I don't want to get too clinical on this, but we need to look at fear for just a second, and maybe dissect it just a little bit. If you've ever been involved in the medical profession, mental health, law enforcement, or the legal business, you will have heard of a document called the DSM. It's a diagnostic and statistical manual of mental disorders. And in it, it has a whole variety of, for lack of a better term, it's the Bible of psychiatrists that look at all the mental diseases that are generally accepted as being actual diseases. And it changes over the course of time. But one of the areas that they have, their little section in there, is for phobias. And the word phobia means fear of. And then you can fill in the blank. And I'll show you that in just a second. But that DSM document really takes those phobias, those fears of, and breaks them into three categories. There's social phobias, which are things that relate to fears that people have about relating to other people and other social situations. There's specific phobias, which are fears related to single triggers. An example would be fear of snakes, fear of bunny rabbits, fear of whatever you're afraid of. And those are single trigger items. And then there's agoraphobic phobias, which are related to, you've heard of agoraphobia, that's people that have a hard time leaving a safe environment, like leaving their house or whatever, and it relates to safety issues, and there's phobias that revolve around that. I did some research, and I thought it was kind of interesting. How many, just take a guess, you guys can't guess, because you already know. How many recognized, just give me a ballpark number, how many recognized phobias do you think there is? Not in the DSM, because they don't do it that way, but the I have a list here of clinically acceptable phobias. How many?
1,000.
300? Okay, if you take the first number and subtract the second number, you're getting close. It's about 650 phobias. And if I asked you, can name me a phobia that you've heard of?
Arachnophobia.
Arachnophobia, fear of spiders.
Photophobia.
Photophobia.
Fear of light.
Fear of light.
Heights. Fear of heights.
Fear of height. Okay. Fire.
Flying.
Flying. Okay. All right. There's all kinds of phobias. If you.
Claustrophobia.
You ever been? Had to get a MRI done? A lot of people can't do that because they put you in that little tube. And I've had one, and I'm not claustrophobic, but I got in there, and about half an hour into it, I'm like, I don't think I could get out of here if I had to by myself. And you start thinking some pretty strange things. This list, if I let you go through it, about halfway through it, you'd be laughing so hard. You can't believe some of the stuff. Fear of chopsticks. It's a recognized phobia. Here's one. I'm not going to tell you what it's the fear of. You tell me what it's the fear of. Ecclesiophobia.
Fear of church.
Okay. There's phobias in here. There's phobophobia. Fear of phobias. I mean, you go down this list, there's fear of dentists, there's fear of dancing, fear of... if you want to look at the list and get a good laugh, some of the stuff I'm having a hard time figuring out how... Fear of garlic. We have got all kinds of fears. Some of these I wouldn't read in this room, though. I mean, but these are theoretically a list of accepted fear ofs. And over the years, people have used those for a whole variety of reasons. So, pardon? What's that?
Fear of staring ducks.
Okay, sounds good. Should probably be on that list. What if fear is an emotion? Can you think of a couple other emotions that are kind of like sidecars that go along with fear?
Anxiety.
Terror.
Worry.
Okay. We're going to talk about worry a little bit later on, but fear as an emotion drags along a lot of things with it, a lot of baggage, and we have to be careful when we do that. The fears become a problem when they disable you and make you unable to function in a lot of cases. But let's take a look at the impact. I don't want to not use David's terminology. He had the wrong kind of fears, which are fears which are groundless. So let's talk about groundless kinds of fears. When you think about fears that are debilitating, but they really shouldn't be a problem, can you think of some characteristics of those? I'll give you one to start with. Have you ever worried or been fearful of something happening? Someone tells you something. Let's say, for instance, you're at work and everybody's abuzz. You know, this guy came into town and he met with the boss, and They're getting ready to downsize the company, and the next thing you know, you're fearful that you're not going to have your job in a couple of weeks. But then later on, you find out that the guy who came to visit him was his cousin and had nothing to do with that, and you had all that fear and worry and concern for no reason. That you have fears based on misinformation. You just don't simply understand what's going on. How about, have you ever seen somebody be fearful of something, but they blow it all out of proportion? You know, something that should be this big ends up being this big. It's huge. It's way out of proportion to what it is. There's an old German saying that fear makes the wolf bigger than he is. If you think about it, you can turn something very small and insignificant into something really big and debilitating and insurmountable, and all it takes is the little chemical reactions in between your ears to make that happen. What about fears that prevent or hinder you from doing things? Can you think of an example of that?
Failure.
Fear of failure. Okay. Any other ones?
Fear of death.
Fear of death. Okay.
Fear of germs.
That's on the list, by the way. There's actually several perturbations of germs in there. I want you to think about it this way. I'll give you an example that happens in the church. You know, you hear the scripture, go into all the world and teach every creature, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, he that believeth not shall be condemned. Now, that's how it reads in my Bible, but if some people, I think they've written their name in there, and it says, go into all the world and teach every creature, and the going part doesn't really apply to Sam, Larry, Jer, you know, it's whoever, it doesn't apply to me. And the reason I don't have to do it is because I'm not good at it. I'm afraid to go knock on a door. I'm afraid to go talk to somebody about this. Is that a valid fear to have? That, you know, I've heard that so many times from people when we talk about personal evangelism that it's almost like a standard excuse, fill in the blank. I'm just not good at that. I can't go do that. Because you decide you can't do it. It's something that's standard. Now, if that's the case, I got a question for you. I live out in Palm Beach Country Estates. The lots are pretty big. They're like 1.25 acres. Cam lives out there. Dan Jenkins lives out there. The Hensels live out there. The Reeves live out there. Several other people. I'm probably left. The Browns now live out there. Why is it about twice a year the Jehovah Witnesses walk down my street and come to my house every single time? They don't skip out. You watch them. They don't skip houses. They go every place. And I can guarantee you that 99.9999% of the time, when they go to the door, they get the door slammed in their face. They get a no. They get whatever. But they keep doing it. Pardon? Well, we told them to go over to your house from my house. So, and it's there's something about the folks as it relates to their faith that makes them do that. So the question is, whatever component they have in their faith that makes them do that, what is it? And what keeps us from sharing God's word? I'm not suggesting that you go out in your neighborhood and walk around and knock on every door, because maybe that's not the most effective way to do it. But you can't use that as an excuse. You can't use fear or that idea that, you know, I'm going to be rejected and I can't do that. I've tried that. I have a whole package at my desk, and I try to give them to them, and they won't swap material. Maybe you got more cooperative people in your neighborhood, but they don't.
He's gotten a couple to do that.
Yeah. I've tried to do it, and I haven't had any success doing that yet. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it. They come into my neighborhood and they do that, in your neighborhood, and they do it all the time. But when it comes to trick or treat time, Kids won't come into our neighborhood because the houses are too far apart. It's too far to walk. You know, they go to another neighborhood where the houses are a whole lot closer and it's a whole lot easier. So we have Jehovah's Witnesses who come into our neighborhood that have a certain kind of faith that motivates them to do what they're doing, knowing that they're going to get rejected almost all the time, and they're moved by that faith. Let's talk a little bit about groundless faith as it relates to a stimulus that sometimes motivates us to disobey God.
Groundless fear? What? Groundless fear or groundless faith?
Fear. Did I say faith?
Yeah.
Scratch that. Fear. Groundless fear that motivates us to do things where we'll disobey God. I'll give you an example to start it off. I think everybody in the room here has been through at least the first, second, and third grade. And you're sitting there, I remember sitting at the desk, you know, it's depending on how big you are, it's like up to here. They give you that grade triple Z paper with the lines, you know, real far apart and a big pencil to write with. And eventually you start having to take tests. And when you take a test and you don't do so well and you take it home to mom and dad, what happens? My parents weren't really pleased. They had some expectations that you were going to perform a certain way. So kids at some point, some kids, they get concerned about, when I have that test, if I don't do good on it, you know, mom and dad are going to not be happy with me. So if you're not grounded properly, what are some of the things that might run through your head? I mean, they'll still run through your head even if you're well-grounded, but
cheating.
You ever find yourself when you're in the third or fourth grade, you're sitting there taking that test, and you get to that question and you go, man, I just don't know what the answer to that question is. But I know he knows. You know, should I look over there? No, I shouldn't do that. And some people will do it, and some people won't. And so when you have, sometimes fears can move us to do things that we shouldn't do that relate to cheating. When we get a little older, think about what happens at work. You go to work. I had the opportunity to work at Pratt for 20 years, kind of interesting little laboratory of, had its own little culture and how things were done. But it's interesting to watch the level that some people will go to manipulate other people, and because they're afraid of something. It's just absolutely amazing that the people will, at work, they'll lie, they'll cheat, they'll steal, they'll do all sorts of things because they're afraid. They're afraid they're going to lose their job. They're afraid that somebody's going to get ahead quicker than they are. It's absolutely amazing. And another one that's of a real concern is the fear of if what we just talked about a minute ago, the idea of going out and sharing your faith with somebody else. There's a fear a lot of times that you're going to be either ridiculed, or you're going to be put down, or you're going to be looked at a certain way. And some people, if they're not grounded in the faith, if they hear enough of that and they get fearful enough, a lot of times they'll just turn their back on. It's more important to me as a person to be a friend with Freddie than it is for me to be a Christian. So I'm willing to abandon what I believe because I'm afraid I'll lose Freddie as a friend if I don't stop what I'm doing over here. And it can be something where you get stimulated to disobey God and go in an alternate direction simply because you're afraid that you're going to lose your friends, your relatives, the love of your family, however you want to put it. So let's look at just quickly for a minute. I think the bell did a little ringy-dingy, so we only got a couple minutes left. Let's look over on 2 Timothy, the first chapter for a second. Second Timothy chapter 1, verses 6, 7, and 8. Paul is writing to Timothy here, and after the introduction, we get down to verse 6. It says, therefore, I remind you to stir up the gift of God, which is in you, through the laying on of my hands. Apparently, Paul has laid his hands on Timothy, and being an apostle, he has certain gifts that he's been given. And it says, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. Does that only apply to people who the apostles laid their hands on? I mean, I don't have any gifts like that miraculous in nature, but should I have a spirit that doesn't contain fear? Should it be of power and of love and a sound mind? That applies to everybody. Okay. Now, there's a couple of instances that you'll be familiar with. We don't have to turn there, but you're going to be very familiar with them. Is sometimes when we look at the kind of faith that we have, when we have too little faith, it kind of is indicative of what happens. And the first one I'd like you to think about is from Matthew chapter 8, verses 23 through 27. Jesus had just finished talking, and then he and some of the disciples get in a boat, and this tempest comes up. And just similar to the example I gave you of the little boy and his father. And wild storm, all kinds of terrible things going on, and they're really concerned. What do? They wake Jesus up, and they go, we're going to perish. And what does he say? O ye of little faith. They've been with him. They've seen what he's done, and he's there in the boat with them, and they're concerned that something bad's going to happen. And he's telling them, I'm right here. Why don't you have faith? It's interesting. Also, another example is the walking on the water when they're in the boat and Jesus just got finished feeding all the thousands of people, and he goes up on the mountain to pray, and the disciples, he says, I'll meet you on the other side, and they go out in the boat, and there's a storm going on, and next thing you know, they see Jesus walking on the water, and there's good old Peter. He goes, you know, can I walk on the water too? And he hops up and he starts walking across the water, and what happens? He starts to have fear. What happens when that happens? Starts to sink. When Jesus takes his hand, what happens? He's back up again. We didn't get a chance to finish the rest of this, and I wish we could have. I did want to tell you a couple things. Those six stories that I started out with at the beginning, all six of them are true. The four that are in the Bible we know are true. And I can tell you that the other two are true because the little boy in the story was me. And the guy laying on the hospital bed was me. So none of us are immune from fear. Even if you have faith, a lot of times you have to re-remind yourself that it's important when those bad things are going on that you need to turn to God, and he can help you through those things. Next week, the lesson's going to be on faith that conquers. I'm just going to leave it there because I don't know what it is. It's kind of like when you watch the show and you got to wait till next week. Well, you don't have to wait till next week to find out what that is. Okay, thanks a lot. We're dismissed.